Blog Talk Radio.
Listening to Patriot Nation Radio Live, 347-637-3942.
Welcome, everybody. It's that time again, Wednesday night, the American Allegiance Show. Last week, we had Brad Geyer, the attorney for one of the prisoners from January 6th in D.C., and it was a fascinating show, probably our most popular show we've ever done. A lot of listeners, a lot of people commented on it. And check my Facebook page out, author Kevin White, and you can donate to that cause because they really need the help. This is something that we need to support because things weren't done right there. And it seems like the D.C. police have more power than our government. And you have to remind yourself that, you know, Washington, D.C. is not part of the United States. That's probably one reason why. So remember those people, and I do know, like I said before, I have a friend who was there. So I sent word through Mr. Geyer for her attorney to say hello, you know, that we're still pulling for them, that we want them to get out fairly and be treated right. It's just appalling what happened there. Also, I want to say that show also, we reached the Philippines. We also reached Australia, parts of Canada, and even parts of Kentucky. Yep, that's right. We have some fans here I just want to recognize. Let's see, Phil Dedrick, Wright Writer. These are people that are fans and they're registered on this page. It's just amazing to me. Things I didn't know were going on, but, you know, it's awesome. So Hank Jones, Polisport, 1980, Ms. Gear, shout out to all y'all, and Hill Gotch. I'll be seeing you later. I hope you guys feel free to call in. We don't know what calls we're going to get from what state or whatever. But this is exciting radio because these are exciting times and things aren't what they used to be. So I'm going to bring on a guest tonight, Mr. Kurt, political strategist. So Kurt, tell me if I'm saying this right. Would you like to introduce yourself, sir?
Sure. Yeah, I'm a political strategist. I live just outside of Nashville, Tennessee, and I work on various different political issues all over the country.
Awesome. So I understand we're collaborating together. We want to put a publication in the future. And it's going to help people run for office. I might use that myself. You never know. Could come in handy for me as well. So, Kurt, tonight we're going to talk about Omicron, of all things, you know, something new in the news and things that, you know, concern everybody, except for the people in Africa that said it only lasts for 2 days and nobody's been hospitalized. But now it's making its way through Europe and the United States. It's a plague of epic proportions. So what's your opinion on that? What's your political savvy tell you about this?
From my standpoint, it's a medical issue. But at the same time, I see where it's going, in a lot of directions with the political issues. the reality is that I think that we're seeing that, you know, with vaccinations going up, then incidence should be coming down, but we're not seeing that. What we're seeing is vaccines going up and COVID going up at the same time. And every time you turn around, there seems to be a new variant. And, you know, there's an article put out the other day where it turns out people with the Pfizer vaccine are having a higher rate of COVID, people who haven't had it. And so I think the real aspect here is the mRNA, the vaccines, the mRNA vaccines, they've been working on them for like almost 30 years, and not one has ever been approved by the FDA. And so now we're seeing where, you know, they've got this acceptance of it from the government. Nobody can sue Pfizer. Nobody can sue Moderna. No, you know, and nobody can sue the government over this. And so it becomes real problematic. I mean, I won't be taking it.
Wow, I didn't know that. That's fascinating. I thought this was all brand new and just showed up. So that's interesting. And like you're right about that, because I see these things all the time. The most populated are the most vaccinated people, and countries and cities have the most issues. So I have an issue when, you know, when, okay, so, and what we're going to go forward, here's going forward for Omicron, you're going to have people who just got vaccinated, just got the booster, and it's no good anymore. So what happens to the other variant that's still around? I mean, it doesn't go away, does it? I mean, something here doesn't smell right to me.
Well, it kind of reminds me of the flu. I mean, every year the flu is a different variant. And all they do with the flu shot is they guess which variant it's going to be. And now it's an educated guess, but it's still a guess. Some years we have worse flu than others, and people die of the flu all the time. So I think in my mind, this is how I look at it. But I think that when you start to take a look at the idea of big pharma and the money that they pump into government, and they've needed this to pay off for a long time, I definitely question whether what we're looking at is the money.
Yeah, they are certainly making a lot of money with all these shots and the boosters. And here's a funny thing, because I'll let you go here in a minute. They talk about this booster being better for you than the actual shot, you know, at this point. But I understand the booster is nothing but half the dose of the shot, so that doesn't make any sense to me. I'm kind of like at a loss to any kind of logic on this virus thing, because it doesn't make any sense. And it seems like they're making things up, and you know, it's the unvaccinated causing all these problems. And there's no difference between vaccinated and unvaccinated. When you want to get out in the public, I mean, you can be a carrier for anything, so it doesn't matter. It doesn't skip you because you're vaccinated. I mean, it's a physical impossibility. So the narratives are like, I don't know if people are believing this. I know a lot of people who are saying they're not going to get the next shot. They're not going to get the next booster. They're done, because we're seeing things now. It's falling apart. Then all of a sudden, out of the blue, there's this new virus variant. And everybody could predict that. You know, obviously, this is what the progression is. So there's a little town or a little country in Africa called Omicronda, and that's where it came from. I'm just making this up. So what's next? This is supposed to be the Frankenstein. Does it get worse? Does it get better? But if you listen to the African reports in other countries, there are no hospitalizations. People aren't sick for more than 2 days. I hope this gets out, because look at the news from Africa. Look at what they're saying. None of this is what they're saying over here. We've got to prepare for the worst of something that is totally harmless, and they know it's harmless. So you're fighting propaganda, but the truth is there. I mean, if you just look for it, when it first came out, I saw the headlines, oh, it's nothing. You shouldn't even have, there's no vaccine to make, and it's going to take you 100 days to do it, which is almost impossible to begin with, even the ones done in 9 months. So my question is, does anybody believe this? Are they going to believe this in the future? What's going to come next? The little boy cried wolf, wolf, you know, eventually.
Well, I think, yeah, and I think that's the thing, is every time you turn around, the sky is always falling, right? And I've got a friend of mine who actually, he saw a post I put on Facebook, and he called me, and, you know, I just mentioned that I was not going to get vaccinated and my kids were not going to be allowed to get vaccinated. I would not allow this. And he called me, and, I mean, he is obviously listening to the propaganda, and he said his father had died of COVID, and it was people like me who were passing COVID, and he hoped that we could still be friends. And now this is the guy who's the godfather of my son. I mean, we are that close. The only thing that I can really say, though, is I saw, and I don't mean to suggest that I leave my thinking to memes, but I saw a great meme that really kind of spoke to what I'm thinking about this. And it was two rats sitting in a cage, and one rat said, are you going to get the jab? And the other one said, no, they're not done with the human trials yet.
And beautiful.
Yeah, but that's the way I think about this. I mean, they've rushed this out. They've never had an mRNA vaccine before. And so now, because of the emergency declarations, we can't sue anybody if we get sick or if things get worse. And, yeah, so I don't trust that kind of process, if that makes sense.
That makes total sense, because I can't see how mRNA has anything to do with, like, an antivirus. You don't have any live or dead virus strains in it. It's completely mechanical. So it doesn't make any sense. And Novavax does have a traditional one, and they turned it down because it's not making them money, apparently. That's just my guess.
Yeah, and I don't know what the particulars are to that, but I do know that you know, with the fact that mRNA has never been accepted by the FDA, and this was rushed to market, and it's being saved by the fact that we have this emergency declaration and nobody can sue anybody if they have any problems. That just raises all kinds of red flags.
Yes, exactly. That's a very red flag. So thank you for joining us tonight, and I know you got stuff to do and you got a dinner to eat, so I appreciate you coming on. We're going to have you on in the future to talk about politics. So I appreciate you coming on and sharing that with us.
Anytime. I appreciate you too, brother.
Okay. Bye. See you later. Bye.
Yep, bye.
So we have a caller on the line. Who is that caller, please? You there?
Yeah, hey, this is Brad Geyer. How you doing, Kevin?
Hey, Brad Geyer, man, the hero from last week. You really brought it to us. Amazing. If you guys miss that show, go back and look at it, listen to it. It'll blow your mind because of the things that we learned about the prisoners and things that we don't know that Brad told us about, you know, the videos that when they come out will scare everybody and, you know, their minds will be changed completely after they see it. But that's in the future. And we thank you, Brad, for bringing that up. It's awesome to be your friend and to have somebody on the inside. And, well, I do have a friend on the inside, but they're not allowed to leave. So things like this are are incredible when you see our freedoms be eroded and taken away. And it's not us, but the people that are there get treated worse to the people that are breaking in the border, or even people on death row get better treatment than they do. It's amazing. So how are you today, Brad?
Doing well. I was gratified to see that one of my esteemed co-counsel for the January 6th defendants filed a case on behalf of Ryan Nichols. Mr. Nichols is a honorably discharged Marine. I believe he's retired. And he was on the west side of the building near the tunnel. And I actually just got done reading. His counsel's name is Joseph McBride, great attorney, great American. And he laid out some of the odd set of circumstances that were happening, that he has folks who are reviewing the videotapes and the surveillance tapes, many of which remain under seal, and seeing all kinds of odd things that are happening, people with earpieces, people who are interacting with members of the Capitol Police and the Metro Police, being in strange ways. One camera angle is pointing from the inside of the tunnel, pointing out, and there's sort of a Tarzan-type character who comes down, swoops down, and doing different things and having different interactions with different police officers. There's somebody that the Capitol Insurrectionists, that's a Twitter group of, their identity is a subject of discussion. Some people say they're former government executives. In any event, they act as a group of people who've been reviewing all the video footage and identifying different people who were there. And some of the people they identified early, like Pippi Longstocking, and I believe it's Red Face 45, maybe. There was lots of attention these individuals early on, and then it just kind of evaporated. They kind of disappeared from the Twitter feeds, and everybody stopped asking questions. And the question in Mr. McBiling that he asks is, isn't this conduct, what we're observing on the videotapes, consistent with some of these individuals perhaps being affiliated with different law enforcement agencies? And, of course, that's important, because if there are agents of different law enforcement agencies who are in the audience getting people whooped up or getting them assisting them in engaging in certain actions they shouldn't have been engaging in under conditions that at the time were very difficult. They were compressed. They were under, you know, there's a lot of enthusiasm in the air. And also at various times, people were acting out of a sense of, you know, fight or flight. And of course, you know, make no mistake about it, there were people who were violating the law and they shouldn't have been doing what they were doing. There were government provocateurs that provides some legal defenses for some of the folks who've been charged. And it maybe provides some context for perhaps self-defense claims or third-party self-defense claims. At least I'm inferring that from what he states in his filing. I'm less involved with what was happening over on the west side of the building, but I'm generally familiar with it, and I've seen some of the videotape since last week on the east side of the building, because our clients are charged with, based on an aiding and abetting theory, and also a Pinkerton theory of liability regarding conspiracy, are being held accountable for any violence that occurred anywhere else below grounds, and also any vandalism that occurred anywhere on Capitol grounds is being imputed to my client based on aiding and abetting theory or conspiracy theory. And, of course, when you look at the videotape, that much of it, or most of it perhaps, remains under seal, you, of course, see that my client did absolutely nothing. My particular client, Ken Harrelson, was volunteering with an organization known as the Oath Keepers, and they swear and uphold a devotion towards the Constitution, the Republic, and incidentally law enforcement. And if you look at the videotape, much of which remains under seal, one thing you don't see is them engaging in any violence whatsoever, or them engaging in any vandalism of any kind. They're basically walking around during the point of time in question, taking selfies, or in the middle of the rotunda, getting down on a knee and saying a prayer. So I think Mr. McBride's point of his filing, or certainly the effect of his filing, and also the effect of certain filings that I've made and I intend to make in the future, is that we're all better off if we get as much information out about this to the public as we possibly can. Because, of course, up until now, the kind of video that people have seen is the video that is, you know, the most violent, which was a very small part of the overall picture of the day. And that's just
right.
Been beamed and repeated and, you know.
Yeah.
You know, there's certain video that literally people, your typical American, has seen over 100 times. Just repeated ad nauseum in a loop. And so my belief, certainly what's expressed by at least one filing that I've done, and certainly what's expressed by what Mr. McBride filed earlier today, is, hey, let's get all out to the American people and let's let them decide.
Yeah, and I think this is going to be huge. When this happens, when all this comes out, it's going to be gigantic. People are going to see what really happened. And it's going to make other people look bad. And it's just my, you know, just my opinion, because this is going to change the narrative. People are going to think differently of what happened in the point that, you know, they had the impeachment trial. All that stuff will be looked at like, what? They did it on that? And, you know, it had the evidence. I mean, it was taped right there, you know, live. So they can't say they didn't know. So this is going to be pretty ugly when those powers that be. And, you know, your client's going to make a lot of money. I mean, you got to sue the government. He's got to.
Oh, my gosh.
And by the way,
I certainly hope so. He's been put through the ringer. Thank goodness his wife, who stays out of all the, you know, tries to stay out of this as much as she can. All she's trying to do is just basically keep the family going. It's been extraordinarily difficult. I'm actually preparing a reply. I hope to file it either, most likely tomorrow. And this is the government's, this is a reply to the government's response to my filing that says, hey, let my client out. He has a totally clean record. He's not a risk of flight. He didn't even have a passport. He's a disabled war veteran. There's no evidence that I've seen that suggests he engaged in any violence at all. He didn't engage
right.
in or countenance any vandalism of any kind. There's really no reason why he should be in under the U.S. Bail Reform Act, in my opinion, at least. It's a clear case where he should have never been detained. And keep in mind that because
yeah.
he was in the wake of COVID, that he was basically in solitary confinement for about 6 months. And
wow.
that's really hard time. You know, he was getting out 1 hour a day. And what the government did here, and I have to say, there's so many different issues that it didn't, I've only begun to really focus on it today. And that is that what the government, you know, the U.S. Department of Justice with the attorneys, prosecutors like I was, the federal government has a prison system that's administered by the Bureau of Prisons. And the Bureau of Prisons is within the Department of Justice. And the Department of Justice has a there was a memorandum that was issued at the beginning of the COVID epidemic, and it really liberalized the conditions under which the prison system could release nonviolent criminals, both sentenced criminals and sentenced prisoners and prisoners who are being held pretrial as part of detention. And what I've just begun to really focus on is whether the Bureau of Prisons, which again is in the Department of Justice, whether they may have delegated the custody of these prisoners from the Bureau of Prisons to the District of Columbia Department of Corrections, because certainly there's an appearance, at least, that that theoretically may have happened to get around the presumption that would have applied to them if they were in Bureau of Prisons custody. So what they did is they took the custody and the obligation for the proper care custody of these special, you know, the special class of defendants. And they,
right.
they basically delegated it to a separate government. And the separate government, somehow this makes sense in government land, bureaucracy land. They reconditioned just just terrible facilities, especially for these defendants, where you have, it's an 8x12 cell. There's sewage that comes out of the water supply. There's mold everywhere. It's just a complete disaster. And so they put them in this special reconditioned facility that wasn't under any obligation that Bureau of Prisons was under, perhaps to let them out. And even more interesting is it reminds me of a lot of these third-party national staffed prisons that were overseas that I was familiar with when I was with the Department of Justice, because a lot of the prison staff are actually third-party contractors, most of whom are from outside the United States. So this is a really bizarre circumstance. At least I'm not familiar with it. If it exists elsewhere, it's news to me. I'm unaware of this happening within the United States, although I'm not an expert on prisons. I have to say that.
Right.
But looking at the situation, it just looks very strange, no matter what angle it is that you're looking at it from.
This is an interesting update because I messaged you because I heard Angel Harrelson, which is your client's wife, was talking about how the agents stormed the house. Now, this is another part of it that is like, okay, this is the suspect, right? They assume that he's deadly dangerous. So here's a little blurb here. It was a normal day at the Harrelson household. Angel was still in training at a new job. So Kenneth was working outside up on a ladder, and then here they come. Next thing you know, he's in handcuffs. So also, Angel explained they had the gun pointed at her too, one of the rifles. So, I mean, this is really scary. This goes beyond anything that's even – you know, remotely reasonable. And she was fearing for her life because they actually had, she thought she was going to get shot if she made the wrong move. She was trying, I can't remember what she was trying to do. She was trying to straighten herself up so that she can be decent, because I guess she wasn't decent at the time, but they didn't care. They came in and took him, and she hasn't seen him since. I mean, it's very scary. That was on War Room. I think it was maybe Monday or Tuesday last week or this week. Or last week, that's what it was. And things that go on and the things that happen in our Constitution, in our country, it's like a third world. Because I remember when I was in overseas in the Middle East in one of the countries that rhymes with Turkey, somebody stole something from the gas station, and they said it was a black man. So they went to the base and jailed the first three black men that on the roster, and they were in jail for a long time. That's third country. I mean, that's foreign country stuff.
God.
That's third world. And it took them forever to get those guys out because they made up the story. Somebody else stole it, and then you know, I was afraid to go off base. I didn't know what was going to happen. Things like that happened, but I don't expect that here. This is the same thing, but they didn't. You know, here. There's no trial like there is over there. There's no counsel. There's nothing. They just put him in jail. And, I mean, that's
Kevin,
the thing. There's no difference.
This thing, after we get this thing properly scoped and rebalanced and we sort of get some of these people who have been wrongly charged, overcharged, rotting away in prison on offenses where, you know, the amount of time served they've served to this point is excessive when you compare it to whatever sentence they could possibly get on whatever it was they did that could be construed as being wrong. But after all that,
right,
after all that is done, there's going to be an assessment as to how our country responded to it and how our governments responded to it. And it's sort of like on the heels of, you know, like it was a culmination of like a ridiculous overheated response to what has been coined as being a pandemic. And I suppose they were about maybe, you know, a year into it when January 6th happened. And everything just kind of culminated. And I would love to know, we're going to start seeing it in Discovery. It'll be under seal, of course, but eventually when it becomes public, I would love to know how it came to be that, you know, any banking transaction that occurred within the Washington, D.C. beltway on that day was turned over to law enforcement. How was it that Facebook came to hand over all of their posting information, including location data, to the government? I've at least read that that happened. All the telephone company information with texting, I've heard that that got turned over. All the
fencing
data, locality data being turned over to the government. This is like, it's almost as if the government has outsourced to private companies the ability to conduct illegal searches and seizures of the Fourth Amendment.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it's having private companies do what it itself can't do. And in some cases, for instance, in the case of, say, a Google or a Facebook, it at least has the appearance that Google and Facebook are complying to get preferential treatment in a host of ways that the government is in a position to provide both those companies. Google has perhaps, let's say, I'm rounding numbers, and I haven't read about this in the last 6 months or so, but let's say that Google has about 90% of public search. Certainly on the handheld market, if you roll in personal computers, I'm not sure, it may go down a bit. But on the handheld, I believe it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 90% of search, which is clearly a monopoly under any definition. And if you look at the level of monopoly enforcement that occurred either from the Antitrust Division or the FTC, or if you look at legislation under Congressman Gerald Nadler's committee in Congress, and by the way, that actually is an effective congressional subcommittee that has a lot of teeth. But if you look at those three monopoly potential means of enforcement, they've had a very lackluster record when it comes to doing anything to rein in the monopoly power of Google. If you look at Facebook has, I'm guessing 70% of Americans perhaps are on that. That's clearly qualifies as a monopoly. I like to say, and I said this in our suit against monopoly on behalf of the vaccine hesitant that we filed in December of 2020. We were very early out of the gate on that. That what Facebook has a monopoly over is the public square, essentially.
Yeah.
The conversations that would occur, say, in Brooklyn between windows across an alleyway and in tenements or in the alleyway itself, you know, on the benches around there where the kids are playing around there, all those conversations, they now happen on Facebook. And Facebook, having a virtual publishing platform and being an aggregator of content, has libel immunities, you know, immunity from reposting libelous material on Google. It doesn't have any liability under that, under an FCC law. And it also seems that it's been allowed over the course of the last decade to gobble up not only its competitors, but any company that might be in a position at some point in the future to become a competitor. And it was allowed to do this with almost zero. In fact, that I say almost zero. I'll just say with zero monopoly enforcement. The antitrust division is wasting its time on, you know, agreements regarding labor markets. Before that was its area of investigative focus, it abandoned the field in regards to grant fraud enforcement and procurement fraud enforcement and science fraud enforcement through grant fraud enforcement. It abandoned
right.
the field.
Wow.
And it was pursuing, if you can even believe it, they took all those prosecutors who were the most experienced white-collar prosecutors in the system, and they focused it on housing auction fraud and gasoline auction fraud. If you can even imagine this, they took all those prosecutors and all those paralegals with all that information technology, technology expertise in regards to electronic discovery, and they focused them all on this narrow, tiny little fragment of law enforcement. So when I look at what's happening now, and I look at how the government has delegated enforcement that it can't engage in because of the Fourth Amendment, and it delegates the power to do that to these companies,
yeah,
then
right.
to conduct illegal searches and seizures. I see the FBI, which is the most talented enforcement agency with the most talented criminal investigators on the planet, and they're running around and going after a grandma who happened to be, you know, who happened to walk, the geofencing technology happens to show that she walked from the Ellipse to the Congress and was, you know, engaging in ribald political demonstration. When I hear that, as outraged I am as an American, and as perverse it occurs, it seems to me to be, as a former enforcer and now as a criminal defense attorney, what really frightens me is I think about how all of those resources have been diverted from the nation's real threats.
Yes.
We have foreign nations that have infiltrated our governmental agencies, that have infiltrated our universities, who have infiltrated
yes.
our scientific labs that are engaged in, you know, coming up with solutions for biowarfare technologies and have come up with, you know, new tracking technologies and radioisotopes and you know, injectable computer chips and all kinds of different things. And we've been largely compromised, and the nation's defenders are the FBI. And what are they doing? They're chasing grandma. It's beneath
right.
them. What I tell my friends is I say, in these agencies, trust me, there's many FBI agents, the vast majority, do not want to be diverted in this way. They recognize their skills. They have like the – I forget the movie, but Liam Neeson in the movie, and I have this unique skill set. I forget what the movie is, but where he goes and he tracks down his daughter. She's been kidnapped. Those are the FBI agents, right? Like when the CCP has infiltrated through the Confucian program, many of our nation's top universities, and they're siphoning off all of the country's intellectual property. Who do you want? You want the FBI to be going after that. You don't want them driving around and flying around the country, going to Illinois and doing a drop-in interview on some school teacher who
right.
happened to get a little bit rowdy on that day, right? There were perhaps 100 people or thereabouts that engaged in crime. Let's get that dealt with, right? But don't besmirch the over 1 million people who were there for the rally. And let's get the FBI realigned once again on protecting our nation.
I agree, because what happened on this event on January 6th will prevent people from showing up at any other events because they don't have their freedom anymore. And that's that's a huge issue. I mean, they were just doing what they had the right to do, and not everybody there is a criminal. Not everybody, nobody. There are people that didn't do anything, like my friend. But from this point on, and I know a lot of people that were there. So this point on, it's something you can't do because you can't trust your government for giving you that freedom of speech. Now, the people that they could actually, you know, people who did something wrong or the people that showed up there that weren't a part of the group that pretended they were. So I can't wait for this to come out. I can't wait for the truth to be known, to be told, for people to tell us what really happened, and what really happened in the prisons and what happened at their houses. It's just something weird about not living in the USA anymore. And like I said, I've been to other foreign countries where they don't play fair, where it's normal to bribe your way out of everything, you know.
Oh my gosh,
and
yeah.
It's not like that here. Yeah. Is that coming next? Well, it's going with the big corporations and you know,
boy,
the vaccine manufacturers.
It's inevitable,
and they're bribing
like
people. Governors. Yeah, you're right. You're right. And this isn't what it's supposed to be. And hopefully things will turn around. I think something like this would be a catalyst to show people they're not playing. When this comes out, this is going to make a huge difference. People are going to see, well, what about that? Then why do they have the impeachment? Why are these people in prison if they didn't do anything? If these people are exonerated, then people are going to say, what is wrong with our government? I mean, there are people, they're just normal people. There are some war veterans in there, heroes like your client, and other people who were just there. They had nothing to do with any kind of, there was no insurrection, no gun, not one gun was found that I know of, besides the employee building. So people are going to be surprised.
You know, that word insurrection is really, it's a pernicious word. And I really had to focus on that, the use of that word and how that word came to be. And in this reply that I'm getting ready to file, I really, the current version of it, we'll see what the final is, but I have to acknowledge that a lot of the damage that has been done, the current prosecutors are on the other side of the table from me. Again, they're you know, totally ethical, and from their perspective, they're doing a great job, and they just disclosed something to me today, you know, big disclosure that undermines a lot of their case, and you know, they could have just sent out to everybody 20 pages, right, and said, here's some discovery, and sent it out, but they didn't do that. They're class acts. They took out from the large disclosure the most exculpatory part of it, which, quite frankly, undermines a major foundational pillar of their entire case. And it's really quite remarkable when you think about how great our system is, and I hold these prosecutors in very high regard. You know, they gave us the crib sheet and said, look, this is the stuff you're going to want to see. They could have buried it. They didn't. They didn't. But that got me thinking about, like, you know what, these guys are really doing everything that they're supposed to do from an ethical perspective. Professionally and personally admire that. I'm thinking, how do we get here? And I think about the press coverage in the days and weeks, I suppose, that followed January 6th. So my client, I guess, was charged, I believe, in early March. And
right.
The cement, in terms of the cement around hardening this misperception into the American people, had already been set before these guys set up.
Guys
came, did their investigations, and indicted their cases. And a lot of the setting of that concrete occurred around this idea that everybody who was in Washington, D.C. that day was engaged in an insurrection. Now, some of which is preposterous, right? Like, you didn't even know, I mean, how I've talked to a lot of people who were there. I've talked to a lot of defense counsel about their clients. In some instances, I've actually talked to their clients. They didn't view themselves as being insurrectionist. They viewed themselves as being involved in a rally or a protest, depending on who you're talking to, that began at the Ellipse, and there was going to be a peaceful march to Congress. Now, what they didn't know is that there were a group, I would estimate, if I had to put a number on it, perhaps 100. No, I think maybe I'm on the outside in terms of the actual number. They never intended on going to the Ellipse and watching the speech or any of that stuff. They went right to the Capitol.
Yep.
And they never had any intentions of engaging in First Amendment-protected speech or expression. They were there to cause trouble and engage in inappropriate ways. And as best as I can tell, there was a there was representation from all sides of the spectrum there. Every now and then I hear it was all Antifa. I don't believe that to be the case. I think that there was some of that. There's some other things as well.
Right.
So if you are going into, if you're the government, you're in the alphabet of agencies that's responsible for providing proper security when there's a lot of enthusiasm, there's a lot of pressure in the air. You know, there's a lot of, you know, historical quality to things. It's sort of in the air. It's palpable. And you know from Park Service filings for rallies and also Capitol filings for demonstration permits, you have a sense. By the way, you know, who would file a demonstration permit? Or I should say, filing a demonstration permit is evidence that you have a legitimate purpose to be there. So it took us a long time to get that information from the Capitol. It was very hard to come by that because, of course,
That's crazy.
There's all these Park Service permits that are filed for, and you know they're called Stop the Steal. Then you know it makes it look a lot less like an insurrection.
Right. That's why they were there.
So and you know we're getting that. You know, late in the day, late in the hour, we're getting that stuff. But I mean, all the damage with replaying 5% of the videotapes that shows the actual worst behavior by very few of the protesters, many of whom were there for all the wrong reasons, that had nothing to do with the million plus people who were at the Ellipse, who just were taking a walk over to the Capitol. By the time they got to the Capitol, there was none of the security was up. Everybody made the assumption that they could, that basically the property had been opened up, which, by the way, it often is opened up. The Capitol, this whole idea that it's locked down under lock and key and it's a secure facility is really not true. There's a cafeteria. Tourists love to go to the congressional cafeteria and have lunch, and they stargaze and they look for their favorite representatives and try to get an autograph. They walk around the rotunda. They walk around the Capitol grounds. So this idea that it's, you know, locked down has really been distorted beyond all.
That's what they have us believe in.
Of actual meaning.
Yeah, they have us believe that is the case. It's always locked down, and nobody gets in, and nobody's going to let them in. If that was the case, then nobody would have opened the doors, period. Or I'm sure you can tour but
when you see thousands of people, first of all, there's no sign that says no, don't trespassing. I mean, frankly, I'm glad there weren't any, right? I don't want to see no trespassing signs on my Capitol. I don't want to see any fences either. I would take down all the fencing everywhere.
That's our Capitol. That's right.
Not just the Capitol. I mean, like the Independence Hall in Philadelphia. I would take down All that security I would take down. A lot of the stuff around the White House, I'm sick and tired of the damn security.
Yeah, that's right.
It's too much. And I think that the more you put up, the more deficiencies you see in the security that you put up, and it just never ends. I would say just a lot of that stuff I would take down, but I'm just one man's opinion. I don't have any authority, right? This is my opinion. But when these people, again, these are just regular Americans are taking this peaceful march, and they see thousands of people around the Capitol in essentially like a festival or a folk festival kind of environment. The presumption they made that they had the lawful – if you see thousands of people in an area, you say, oh, my gosh, thousands of people are violating the law. They're actually committing crimes right now for those that like they're all each one of those thousands of people has the mens rea that they're violating criminal law. Or do you assume that they're lawfully entitled to be there? Because you wouldn't see all those people there if it wasn't legal. And so there is a weird, strange crowd mentality that was allowed to filter its way in during the day. And it took many strange forms, and it was all, in my opinion at least, preventable, because I'm not sure exactly why, but my best information suggests that there were fewer security resources at the Capitol that day for whatever reason. And I'm an old salt in the government, so I don't just assume that somebody was acting with malicious intent, or they were acting out of a political mindset, to Pelosi or to, benefit Pelosi. The first assumption I make is just good old fashioned government incompetence. and in the last, in looking at this over the last few weeks, I'm in about the same place I started on government incompetence. I've started to move a little bit, to inch a little bit towards a partial explanation for liability, comparative negligence, if you want to say. To some people in positions of with decision-making authority who, for various reasons that included politics, but not primarily driven by politics, made some ill-fated decisions. Some of it, to give you an example of it, like what I would deem to be a non-political bad decision, is that it seems as if there was a concern that if they really, really beefed up security, it would have the appearance of how the demonstrations appeared outside the White House when that church was set alight, and there were demonstrations on the road right outside the White House, and it was a march to the church, and I think the Secretary of Defense wore a uniform, and it was problematic, and it was somewhat of a press spectacle. And I think that some of the people at the Congress, they like to fancy themselves as being austere and above those kind of displays of politics as it relates to security. They may have opted for a more subtle, lower key, smaller footprint approach and kind of hope for the best. So that's the kind
of that's them, all right.
Okay, we can say in retrospect, boy, it was a mistake, and or it's really tragic that they came down that way. But on some level, any kind of bad feelings or criticism you would have might be mitigated by the fact that at least they had good intentions, or at least there was some kind of presumptive reasonable motivation,
right,
that ended up with the result you had. I see a little
bit of
suggestion.
Let me ask you a question.
Go ahead.
Okay, after this, I need to ask you, we're going to switch to Omicron, the Omicron disaster that's coming. The death, the Black Death is coming from Africa. So I'd like to hear your opinion on that, because you are, I consider, an expert on these vaccines and the diseases and the cures. So you go ahead and finish what you're going to say, and we'll move on.
Yeah, I'm not an expert. I've always said I'm not an expert on anything as a prosecutor, defense attorney. I come into contact with a lot of really smart people, you included, right? And I'm a quick study. What I'll say about Omicron is that I believe, based on my investigation I did in association with filing the Facebook suit, and now our nonprofit is busy staffing up a citizen panel of inquiry regarding pandemic crimes and crimes against humanity. And the part of that that fascinates, there's different aspects of it that fascinate me, but one part that fascinates me the most is I believe that in around January and February, let me think back now, middle of January into February, the World Health Organization, CDC, and other World Health Organizations went to different countries around the globe, including countries that are in designated malaria zones. These proliferate around the equator, but go as far down as, say, in terms of north to south, I think it's around maybe Maryland or New Jersey, thereabouts. And I think that they went around to these countries and started negotiating different aid packages based on projections on when the mRNA vaccines would be ready. And there's a whole other backstory on that that we're busily investigating. But it's it's not a coincidence that within a month of the public disclosure of COVID-19, governmental public health agencies seem to have been sharing information about mRNA vaccines. Like, it was that fast. And the reason is that they are both being co-developed. And I'll have more information about this in the weeks to come. But through the gain-of-function research, they were refining the transmissibility and the serious health consequences associated with SARS viruses while they came up with antidotes, and it was sort of being done simultaneously. And a lot of that, I think, was probably well-intentioned, although it went cattywampus. And I think the best evidence right now suggests that there was either a purposeful disclosure of the COVID-19 virus, or there was was dumped by mistake. All these efforts since then to tie it back to live animal markets. I believe my own personal belief is that is what could be.
And everything starts in Africa anyway.
It's going out
for some reason.
Oh, my phone goes out for 8-second increments periodically. Some
right, but I filled that space in. I filled in that space because I'm turning into
nice.
A pro here. So I was saying that,
radio.
right. Yeah, professional, small potatoes. So I was saying all these things seem to start in Africa, but sometimes they use Australia, and they shut down the countries and they still get over to the U.S. It's just amazing how that happens. and I mean, the first one started in China, but it seems like they always experiment in Africa. And you hear the stories, horror stories and everything, just like Africans, a lot of these countries, and like you're saying, the equator area, they don't have a problem because they have, they are taking the malaria medications. And that's what I took when I went to Africa for a TDY, Enduring Freedom. Nobody got sick. If you don't have that, then you're going to get it. So the same thing happens here. It all begins east of Wakanda, and then it comes here. And it's like, I see the news. Okay, it's in Australia now. Oh, it's in Canada. Oh, we got a case in the United States. So that's for all the lockdowns. That's pretty incredible how that travels, and you know, and how it mutates while it's traveling to something better. I don't know if you heard the first part of the show, but the African authorities are saying that there's no problem with the Omicron. It has nothing to do. There's no hospitalizations. It's only 2 days long, and it's very mild. Some people don't even know to have it. But now, across the Atlantic, it is 10 times mutated to where the point we're going to have Omicron, the bride of Omicron, the son of Omicron, super Omicron, everything you can imagine, the metaverse Omicron coming. So, I mean, it's just amazing.
And of course, the vaccines, of course, create pressure for the mutations. And so you're in this constant war that you always lose to bring the, you know, the updates on the vaccine to beat the mutations. Of course, you never can do that. And everybody knew in early 2020 that, you know, if you paid attention to the actual legitimate infectious disease doctors, they all warned everybody about the peril of going down this mRNA vaccine track. Because it would prompt all of this mutation, and in fact you had the original variant for more than a year. The original C19 virus for more than a year, and it wasn't until all these variants started to explode that all occurred after the rollout of these vaccines. Now you could could be the case, and you know we need to get a real expert on this, but it occurs to me that a lot of the big drug company human subject testing occurs in Africa. So the impression that we have that a lot of these viruses are coming out of Africa may be more a reflection that a lot of the human testing is occurring in Africa, and not something endemic to its locale or other factors. And I'm not an epidemiologist, but I'd be curious to see what, say, somebody like Dr. Harvey Reich or Dr. Robert Malone thought about that. Now, in regards to Wuhan, I mean, yeah, you know, it's a great point. I mean, gee, does it make sense that you had this breakout from a wild animal market, or does it make more sense that it was this weaponized virus that U.S. taxpayer funds paid for that moved to two or three different locations because it had to basically escape legal regimes that were brought in to try to prevent it from continuing. And you end up in Wuhan with CCP involvement, and it gets out either by mistake or on purpose. And then in January and February, you had this big effort in the malaria zone countries to get control over the widespread use of malarial drugs. And I think at some point, I don't think it happened as early, control over ivermectin. I don't think that was discovered as you know, some infectious disease doctors would have known, because that works on multiple pathways, as I understand. So it would have been logical that would work. But the fact that hydroxychloroquine might work, that was known because it was effective with SARS. And because going back to Spanish flu in 1917, where they had great effect through quinine, and then I forget exactly how many studies, but I think it was 20 studies or 30 studies since the Spanish flu, any infectious disease doctor would have immediately suspected that hydroxychloroquine worked for Wuhan. And in fact, I mean, I heard about that when I was in Vietnam in February. I read about it on a Reddit subreddit on coronavirus in January that they were getting good results from hydroxychloroquine, but as a dual therapy, not a monotherapy. SARS-2 required an additional cofactor. So what was being done is they were using zinc ionospheres, but there were other things, and I believe it was in the first week of March or thereabouts, my friend, who was formerly from a CIA agent, was actually on the briefing call, the video briefing call with Dr. Zelenko, where they were going,
great guy,
where they were seeing a presentation on how you needed the dual therapy to actually be effective. Around that time, my friend, who's a physician, who I won't give any more identifying information, provided me with a World Health Organization protocol, treatment protocol, that included as the preferred treatment for COVID-19. This is the first week of March 2020. It was the first line of defense for both early treatment and treatment prior to hospitalization and treatment post-hospitalization. What was recommended was hydroxychloroquine and zinc. It was 400 day one, 400 day two, 200 day three, 200 day four, 200 day five. And most tellingly, in that World Health Organization protocol, which the entire globe at that time was orienting around, they actually included pediatric dosing. That's how safe hydroxychloroquine was, because, of course, it was approved in 1955. It's been used well over a billion scripts around the world. Red Cross. The Red Cross did a study based on longtime users of.
Yeah, I've actually taken that 30 days before we left. Got to take
inflammation
it.
And cancer. Yeah. Right. So this is the safest drug. Until a number was done on it on Wikipedia, right? It would refer to it being the World Health Organization's indispensable medicines, right? So this is the safest drug you can possibly have.
Uh-huh.
And they proceeded to do a sabotage number on it.
That's right.
By the middle
Good job.
Of March through June. And what I believe that our criminal, I look forward to making criminal referrals to federal investigative agencies.
Wow.
For criminal prosecution. Whoa. I believe that there was a massive effort to sabotage hydroxychloroquine. It was done
this
in
big
a whole
news.
Host of ways that we will lay out.
Awesome. You know, that needs to happen. I look forward to that because, I mean, I took the drug. Everybody, hundreds, thousands of Army guys and Air Force guys and Marines, we all, every time we went to Africa, people over there now are taking it. And they don't have a problem with it. It's not a dangerous drug. It's going to keep you from getting sick. And it happens to be related, this COVID-19, to the SARS or for whatever is causing the other problems that they have with malaria. This has to be, or you don't have an effective military. The military knows that. They wouldn't give it to you if they didn't. So, this is a miscarriage of justice, freedom of speech. People have died. You know, one of my friends passed away, Presley's son. And because they were trying to get him all the, the therapies and everything, and the hospital refused. They put him on a ventilator. He was writing on Facebook at the time, and a great friend of mine. We used to talk after some of the talk shows I was on, and he says, I'm going to make it, I'm going to get through, and he didn't. And Don and Donna were good friends, and they were actually part of that, Donna Fiducia Newman. So it was heartbreaking, and, you know, it's something that was not necessary. He did not have to die. He was a war hero too, you know, a chaplain in the Navy, and these things
we have
necessary to...
absolute carnage happening in the nation's hospitals right now. And
right.
What has to happen, and we actually met on this last night, and on Monday we had our standing remdesivir telephone call with remdesivir victims and remdesivir survivors, most lost loved ones, but we heard personal testimony from one of the most informed people that I've run into of late, who actually just battled the hospital. And the hospital still put her father on remdesivir, contrary to both their orders. They, like, snuck it in. And he survived somehow. He's a Vietnam War vet, having some problems walking, has some physiological issues now. You know, they believe it's related to the remdesivir. But there's a very sinister system that's in place that's based on protocols and standing hospital orders, and it's all oriented around maximizing billing rates. We find trends where people are brought into local facilities. They max out on some sort of billing clock, and then they're transported to a larger facility where they go to a COVID ward. Oftentimes, if they go to a large hospital, they'll go to the emergency room. They bypass a room, and they go to a COVID room. There's bonuses for putting people on ventilators, which is the absolute wrong way to treat. There's bonuses for giving people remdesivir. There are stiff disincentives and penalties for giving these patients actual cures. So, like a physician looking at it now, there's a dozen reasons why, as a practical matter, they just can't cure the patient using ivermectin, as an example.
Right.
And if they were to stick their neck out and lose their board memberships on this pharmaceutical board, or become a subject of an investigation of the state medical board, or lose some of the calculated billing factors that are assigned to them from insurance companies and CMS. If they were to ignore all that and do ivermectin and something bad happened, they can then be sued. And it's almost a strict liability standard because they went off the PrEP Act protocol. But if they stay in that PrEP Act, I mean, this is death by statute. That PrEP
Act
is such an evil instance of legislation. I'm sure it's unintended, but what it did is it created a financial mechanism, a financial machine, a moving walkway where Americans are put on the moving walkway and they're moved right over to a cemetery plot, basically. And it's going on.
It's Squid Game's light.
Hundreds of thousands at a minimum are being killed by this PrEP Act protocol. Everybody is conferred indemnification and immunity. And this is very important. Everybody has to hear this. This is completely invalid, and these immunities will not be durable. In other words, physicians and nurses who are administering emergency use authorization vaccines, which are not vaccines, or medications like remdesivir, they are under an obligation that is built upon a foundation of 80 years of law that permeates state federal law, constitutional law, international criminal law. Wow. And they are obligated.
That's huge.
Each person who administers an experimental vaccine or medication to a patient comply with the Nuremberg protocols and the Helsinki protocols. And that includes disclosing all financial considerations, all potential conflicts. They have to make sure the patient understands every aspect of that medical experiment that they're being asked to participate in. And in my opinion, in the future, and the future will come around much more quickly than people now can see, when this is looked back on, it will ultimately be found that nobody gave informed consent. Because after all, how many people getting a vaccine realized when they got the vaccine that they were in that point forward, that they'd really bought a subscription program to more than one mRNA vaccines per year, and that they were going to be tested lab subjects for the rest of their days on Earth? Who knew that?
Yeah.
Who made the informed decision to accept that shot? And I submit to you and I submit to your listeners, nobody did. And that's why I say, in all likelihood, this will be found to have been crimes against humanity. Crimes against humanity do not have statutes of limitation. And every single healthcare provider at the point of administration, experimental vaccine or medication, whether it's remdesivir or it is an mRNA vaccine, they are under an obligation to make damn sure that that patient is giving their informed consent, free of coercion and free of disinformation. And if you look at how the whole thing was presented to the country, I can't imagine how you can comply with, or how you can present this to a potential patient where coercion has been removed and where there's been actual, like, full transparent disclosure of what's involved. I can't even imagine it. It's that outlandish to think, because the situation is so nuts.
Exactly. And here's what I've been thinking. My thoughts on this is they are going to get away with this. They're not going to get away with the mandates. It's going to fall apart right now. The contractors, federal contractors, there's a hold on that. There's holds on other things. What is that? OSHA. OSHA has nothing to do with this kind of stuff. So there's so many violations in the Constitution that will not stand. And like you're saying, with the medical treatments and the Nuremberg Code, there is no way, once people start waking up, this is going to stand. I think there's a lot of catalysts coming forward, and you're seeing this in the courts. Don't know what the Supreme Court is going to do. Why does it take 10 years for the Supreme Court to make a decision? They're just interpreting the laws. They're not making the laws. I hope that people see this and that people will pay a heavy price for what they've done with blind allegiance. And this is amazing, because I have friends who got the jab swearing that they never would, but they wanted to feed their families. They would be able to sue everything. You're right. I think the perpetrators, doesn't matter if they got any kind of claws, should be punished. I think the vaccine companies and all these people that are screaming all this stuff that you got to do, it's your constitution, and people being punished and fired are going to have cases. What's your thoughts on that?
Yeah. We're already starting to see it. So a month ago, I was looking at remdesivir as a potential cause of action. And in the last week, I've almost figured out a way to get through all the indemnifications and legal immunities. One case is where it's essentially battery. They got so sloppy, and everybody got so conditioned to just do whatever the medical people were saying, that the remdesivir was administered over the objections of both the patient and the patient's advocate.
And right. That happened to my friend, yes.
And so anybody that happened to, they have a very viable cause of action. And by that I mean, part of what my nonprofit does is help victims. And we have a pro se project where we don't give legal advice, but we help support with proper information and moral support and other kinds of support. We help the people file pro se suits on their own behalf, and then we also help prepare litigation and then help get it assigned to counsel in the 50 states. And then when possible, and when we have, you know, time availability permits and resource allocation permits, the attorneys who work with me will pick up the cases through their law firms as well. And I can see that there's going to be significant uptick in cases regarding remdesivir. Mm-hmm. And what I see is that a lot of these, that's going to be the initial, these battery cases, essentially, where they got so sloppy on consents that the hospital can't establish that they got the proper consent. Now, you still have major challenges with causation and establishing damage because, you know, it's probably one of the reasons why the drug was chosen. But the side effects from remdesivir look a lot like the side effects from COVID-19. And it's not one of the things that's going to, like right now, we don't have a real good way to take tissue samples and be able to establish the difference between the cause of death that came from COVID-19 versus the one that came from remdesivir. There's pathologists who think that teen deaths are from remdesivir. Like, these are legitimate pathologists, right? Like board certified pathologists that say this. And yeah, it's the whole nother area of inquiry that has to be done. If we get more volunteers on our platform, I'd love to take this one on. Also, is to track, unearth the history regarding this, and write a white paper on what happened to autopsy policy in the United States in the wake of COVID. Like, I believe there were significant and profound changes that occurred, and I want to be able to tie that back to the rest of the pandemic crime timeline. I mean, was this a subject of planning? Was this adaptive? Was it all based on public health considerations or safety of coroners? Or, you know, can you tie it back even further and see, you know, was there some grand design that was based around bad intent? And I'm not ready to go there yet, but I mean, you start seeing these different pieces, how you have, you know, this taxpayer funds developing, maximizing gain of function capabilities while, you know, that's running in parallel with developing mRNA vaccines and sort of merging,
right,
the in terms of who sponsored that, who's involved in that, merging that somehow with the CCP. You have big, massive,
yep,
changes in terms of autopsy policy, so it makes it very difficult to tell cause of death for anybody died from COVID-19. You have mass die-offs in nursing homes in at least 5 states.
Right.
Yep. Which, again, like, no curiosity, seemingly no official curiosity about why those deaths occurred. I mean, these are like little mini genocides. And right now we're focused on, you know, Governor Cuomo's sexual harassment case or whatever. Like, who cares about a sexual harassment case or what Chris Cuomo did? What I care about is, okay, how did 50,000 old people get snuffed out? That's what I care about. Right?
Yep.
So
it's like four or five governors
gradually,
did that.
it's remarkable, and just that people are so asleep, where we can just all sit here while all these terrible things are happening, and just stay disassociated from it, where we don't believe we have an obligation. I mean, that's what I learned from my Holocaust training, studying the Holocaust and Holocaust training, is you have an obligation to speak out. You have an obligation to record the truth. You have an obligation to resist. You have an obligation to fight back and use all legal means to fight back. And it's not just like you do it when you can or if you can. No, you are obligated to do it.
Obligation.
As you know, your membership as a human being and in humanity as an American citizen, obligated to fight back. That's your obligation, because we're stewards of this great bountiful harvest that we were trusted with while our generation is here. And there's too many people who are not basically doing their duty. We got to get more people to do their duty.
Let me interject here. Your group is called Former Feds Group.
Former Feds Group Freedom Foundation. It's Former Feds Group. FedsGroup.org.
Yeah, everybody.
And you put a .com on it, you can get to the January 6th filings.
Right. There's a lot of stuff on there, and you can donate to Former Feds. They're doing the hard, heavy work that I never dreamed anybody was going to do. Like you're talking about, people are still going to be held accountable, the companies, the medications and everything. This is very important, and I appreciate in the whole country, everybody who believes in this, in the Constitution, appreciates what you're doing and what your group is and what you're doing for the prisoners of January 6th. And it's very admirable. And you, as a former DOJ attorney, here as an insider, you have a lot more insight as what's going on. So I appreciate you and your group and what they're doing. Because, like I said, I have a friend I know personally that's in there. I can't even imagine what they're going through as far as the vaccines go. And I don't know what's going to happen. So if you're vaccinated now, you won't be vaccinated next week. That's how I look at it. You're never fully vaccinated. And that's the scary part. And I don't know what they're doing with those people having heart attacks and everything. So it's just incredible. People are putting up with this, and people are acting like it's normal. That's what gets me the most.
Exactly.
They're adamant about it. You got to get the shot. Why didn't you get it? There are people I work with. It's like, oh, they didn't get the shot. I didn't get the shot either. So what? It's none of your business. You can't ask me to get one. That's not even a question you can ask. Just like what's his name? Just like the football player. I can't remember his name. Anyway, you can't ask them that question. That's a personal question. You don't need that. But thank you, Mr. Geyer. We have a minute left. And I appreciate you coming on. And I know you got bigger things. What was it, next week? You're with the new ones?
Oh, yeah. The Cowboy Logic on Sunday.
Yeah.
And I hope to have two new filings this week. They're both replies. And working on some new motions to bring. That, again, it's my obligation to put, you know, and by the way, the government prosecutors on this side expect me to do exactly what I'm doing. I'm happy about it.
Yeah. Yeah, 10 seconds left. You have 10 seconds. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks, Kevin. Appreciate it, man. Have a great night. Thanks for your support.
Oh, you too. Awesome.